American Manners, next on Soundings. Hello, I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for conversations with Patricia Meyer Spax of the University of Virginia and Richard Bushman of Columbia University. Patricia Meyer Spax talks about her study of boredom and culture. Later on the show, Richard Bushman discusses the refinement of America, his new history of social mores in the United States. Major funding for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund, Incorporated.
And boredom can only be a concept if you think that there is an alternative to boredom. In other words, if you have a notion that life is supposed to be interesting, then you can have a notion that it is, in fact, boring.
Patricia Meyer Spax teaches at the University of Virginia. Her previous work includes studies of gossip as a form of social discourse and of the literary culture of 18th century England. Her recent scholarship focuses on boredom as a cultural phenomenon. While boredom is a condition that most of us either try to avoid or accept, the questions remain. Is it essentially personal or is it social? And how does it express itself culturally? In preparing for my conversation with Patricia Meyer Spax, she surprised me with the fact that boredom is a word without a history.
It surprised me, too. I suppose that was the origin of my interest in the subject, was looking it up and discovering that the word has absolutely no history. It came out of nowhere, somewhere in the middle of the 18th century. And the French word ennui, which we think of as closely related, is a 12th century word, but it didn't come into English until the very end of the 17th century. So what I conclude from that is that the English didn't need a word for it until the 18th century.
Why England? Why the 18th century? What sorts of forces came together to create this word?
Well, this is only speculation, of course, but England in the 18th century was, of course, going through the Industrial Revolution. This was a period in which, as all social historians seem to agree, leisure was for the first time becoming a distinct phenomenon as opposed to work, and women in particular had a great deal of time on their hands. That's surely one reason why boredom came into the world, if that is indeed what happened.
You also told me that it has something to do with the decline of Christianity. How about that?
Yes, in the Christian system, of course, people had a very strong sense of personal responsibility and believed that life on earth was not supposed to be pleasurable. It was life after this life that was important.
Life is earnest, life is real.
Right. And boredom can only be a concept if you think that there is an alternative to boredom. In other words, if you have a notion that life is supposed to be interesting, then you can have a notion that it is, in fact, boring. But But the idea of boredom comes with more concentration on this life here on Earth.
Well, let's talk about women and the literature of the 18th century. Again, you told me about conduct books that urged women to be anything but bored. How about that?
That's right. The conduct books, both by men and by women, were full of a perception that women, in fact, don't have very much to do. There is a famous conduct book, probably the most famous conduct book of the century, is by a man named Dr. John Gregory, written to his daughters. And he says to his daughters, you must learn to embroider and knit and do needlework. Of course, nothing that you do will have any value or utility, but it will at least fill up your time.
Was this sexism? Is that what we call it today? Was it recognized as such then?
Well, it wouldn't be recognized as sexism. It was recognition of the actual facts of experience, which were that women simply didn't have much to do, especially before they were married. And in the space of leisure, boredom, of course, might intrude, but people were very worried about that. I mean, conduct book writers were very worried about the possibility that women might declare themselves bored, and told women that if they were bored, they were really reprehensible. One man says, if you declare that your life is tedious, you are like a prostitute.
Oh my goodness!
It was really dreadful. They worried that if women were bored, they would read novels, they would think sexy thoughts. So there was no telling what they'd do. It was very dangerous. Very dangerous.
Well, tell me about sensational novels. That is to say, women have many things happen to them in these books, but one of them is that they don't have time to sit around and get bored.
Yes, there was a problem. Of course, women started functioning as fiction writers in the 18th century, and they had a problem about what to write about. A realistic novel about female experience would run the risk of being boring, because in real female experience, very little happened. So toward the end of the 18th century, many women began writing what we now call gothic novels, sensational novels, in which a very great deal happened. But what happened to young women in these novels was entirely awful.
Surely we don't put, the readers in the 18th century didn't put that much credence in all of these utterly sensational things that they found in novels by and about women, or did they?
No, they certainly didn't believe that those were realistic novels. They read them for entertainment, as people might read Harlequin romances now. They were, but women were apparently the main readers of these novels, as well as the main writers of them.
What about the idea of what you call the interesting or the important, and its relationship to the notion of the boring or boredom?
There are a whole bunch of words: interesting, boring, exciting, amazing, thrilling. All of these words in their modern senses came into the language only in the late 18th century or the early 19th century. And these are all words that describe people's responses to experience. They purport to describe an experience. You say, that was a thrilling ride. But what you really mean is, I was thrilled by it. And the word interesting among these words is particularly complicated, because interesting was an old word. It used to mean something quite different. It meant mainly important. And in 1768, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, it was for the first time used meaning something appealing to an individual. And so at the end of the 18th century, the beginning of the 19th century, writers like Jane Austen are very conscious of these two different meanings of the word interesting, and play with them in their novels.
No, it has something to do with the idea of individualism, does it not? That is to say, the one and the many, myself in relationship to everything that is not myself.
That's right. All of these words that I've just mentioned, the fact that they come into the language in a new sense means that for the first time, individual personal experience is being given a higher value than a public experience.
There's also a political dimension here, is there not, Pat Spax? You mentioned, for example, the rise of political theory, the notion of rights. How does that connect to boredom or the boring?
Well, I think of the right to a pursuit of happiness. It's related to what I was saying earlier about Christianity. Right. As soon as you have the notion of the possibility of pursuing happiness, that implies that there's a possibility of achieving happiness, and that implies that you judge your experience. And much of the time, as it turns out, you're likely to judge your experience, your everyday experience, as boring.
Is boredom alive and well in the 1990s?
Boredom is really thriving in the 1990s. I've been making a little collection of comic strips and advertisements that have to do with boring, and it's quite an amazing collection. I guess my favorite ad is one that ran in the New Yorker for a while, and the copy went, "Fly around the world in the Concorde. Everything else is boring." That seems to be a very good example of the way boredom is now used to describe everything that is not good. Of course, kids use it that way. Teenagers describe the world as boring when they are irritated with it. And high school teachers have told me that it's their greatest problem in the classroom is the fact that students will simply insist that whatever they're being taught is boring.
So what are we doing to our students? We're giving them the option of being bored?
We're giving them the option of being bored. That's a very good way of putting it.
How about your kids at the University of Virginia? I don't know to what degree this kind of topic gets into your undergraduate teaching. How do your students react?
Well, I've talked to my students more about the interesting than the boring, partly because when I was in college, I remember being told in my freshman English course that interesting was not a critical adjective, that it described a personal response, and it wasn't really a critical adjective.
Very evasive.
I have been suggesting to my students that it can be a critical adjective if you understand that the assignment of the interesting and of the boring, for that matter, has to do with your cultural situation as well as with your personal situation. It's not, after all, just a personal response, but, you know, Teenage Mutant
Ninja Turtles.
Ninja Turtles. Right. I mean, if you think of that as something that suddenly everybody of a certain age is interested in, every individual may feel as though she has personally discovered this phenomenon. But of course, it's something in the culture that says now this is something to be interested in.
Have you been bored writing this book, Pat Spax?
Not for a minute.
Well, look, I want to thank you for your contribution to Soundings. You are the Edgar F. Shannon Professor of English at the University of Virginia. Patricia Spax, the author of Desire and Truth. That's your most recent book from the University of Chicago. And we can look forward not to being bored by your book on boredom in September of 93. Thanks for coming by and good luck in your work.
Fun. Thank you.
You're listening to Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond.
It's a history of a people's culture. My aim was to try to figure out what was going on in those houses. And I finally came to the conclusion that all that magnificent decoration went along with costume, it went along with manners, and even more than that, an inward sensibility about how people should relate to one another and what kind of feelings they should have.
The refinement of America. Join me now for a conversation with Richard Bushman, a professor of history at Columbia University. We'll talk about his new book, A Study of Manners and Social Mores in the United States. The Refinement of America, subtitled Persons, Houses, and Cities, was just published by Alfred Knopf. Richard Bushman's interest in social refinement started with America's colonial mansions, those grand houses that sprang up from New Hampshire to Georgia in the early 18th century. But according to Richard Bushman, the refinement of America actually began around the end of the 17th century. It was then that merchants and planters in the New World adopted an ideal of life that encompassed concepts of civility and urbanity. Those concepts in turn expressed themselves not only in architecture, but also in new ways of speech, dress, body carriage, and social manners. I asked Richard Bushman to describe how, in his work, he distinguishes between the material aspects of American social life and the idea of refinement.
Well, the culture that we're talking about, we would use a word like gentility or polite or urbane. This culture really is the culture of the courts. One of the things we've learned in the last 20 or 30 years, or relearned, is that forms of government have a culture attached to them. The culture of republicanism is simplicity and plainness. The culture of the courts is gentility. And so in America, we had this peculiar situation of we repudiated aristocratic government, but we continued to embrace aristocratic culture.
George Washington didn't want to be called a king, but he wanted to live like one?
He wanted to live with dignity worthy of a president, and they could conceive of no other way to present that form of dignity than in the culture borrowed from their aristocratic forebears.
Be concrete for me, Dick. How did these impulses express themselves in architecture and furniture, things like that?
Well, the genteel world is encoded, that is written up for us to read about in what they called courtesy books, we would call etiquette books, which described how to behave at the table and relationships with people and everything else. And those courtesy books describe a world that was essentially a world of entertainment. The heart of it was the drawing room, where you gathered for tea and for talk. also the ballroom, also the garden.
And what's the difference between all of these and the parlor? I want to come to that.
Well, that's exactly what I was getting at. The drawing room is then adjusted for middle-class use in the parlor, which is kind of a junior drawing room. And by putting a parlor in your house, even if you used it very rarely, you were specifying that you were a genteel family who was capable of entertaining.
All right. Now, the parlor in its etymology has something to do with sitting and talking. Is that right? And this assumes a certain kind of behavior that we're all going to quit acting like ruffians or whatever and sit down and exchange ideas?
It required all sorts of changes to become a parlor people. You had to speak in the right way. You had to be polite, hold your body in a certain way, your mouth in a certain way. But if you were a farmer who had a large barn outside, you had to transform yourself before you could enter your own parlor.
This is the stuff of American literature. I mean, how many of our poets and writers have talked about the city mouse and the country mouse and the high and the low? And here we're looking at it, well, not altogether in a new light, but certainly with fresh eyes.
It's a plot made to order, in fact, became one of the major forms of cultural work, as we now speak of it, writers of fiction. That is, you had to describe how people crossed that barrier, how they dealt with the tensions along that barrier.
This is also the beginning of what we call our service industries, is it not? That is to say, if not catering, then figuring out how to live the best life you can live.
The problem for middle-class people was that a few of them would have servants, but never a staff. So that middle-class women had to work in the back of the house and then move forward to the front of the house and become a lady. And they were constantly torn between these two roles. They were living double lives.
Is this what you mean by vernacular gentility?
Vernacular gentility is this watered-down version of aristocratic gentility that is made to be consumed by the middle class.
What did all of this refinement of America have to do with education in the United States? Does it express itself at an institutional level that way?
Well, education has many sources, and I wouldn't say that gentility was a major cause of education, but gentility absorbed into itself the notion of mental culture, that is, primarily that you should read and fill your mind with information, because the aim of education for genteel purposes is not to make a living, not to pursue scholarship, but to talk. The highest of the genteel arts was conversation.
Mm-hmm. So,
and to be a man of parts, or I guess we would now say a woman of parts, you had to have your mind stocked with this vast inventory of information and opinions. So the conversation took the form of crackling, witty statements, sharply formulated opinions, moving around the circle of these gracious people.
And all of this had its other emblematic expression in dress and body language, posturing. Is that the right word to use?
Perhaps we would say posturing. They thought it was the most natural and correct way to stand, to represent yourself at your best. That was absolutely essential, because nothing that genteel people did was any different from what was done in a common tavern by ordinary people. They ate, they drank, they flirted, they talked, they listened to music, they danced, they played cards. All of those things would happen in the most vulgar, coarse circumstance. And the only thing that made the difference was the manner in which people conducted themselves and the environment, which elevated commonplace activities into this higher sphere.
Is this where we locate the beginnings of what we call highbrow culture in this country?
I think you can very easily trace it to gentility. There's been work done in European culture that definitely makes that point, that in an earlier era, say the 16th or 15th centuries, the people who lived in the great halls would have kind of a culture there, but they would also have a culture that they shared with the common people. They would go in the villages for festivities. By the end of the 18th century, they're beginning to be very condescending about this. They withdraw from this common culture. Think of it as debased and debasing, and really would be taint them to participate in it too fully.
Well, now, intrinsic to what you're saying here is the notion of class. That is to say, I'm better than you, she, or it is better than I, all of that sort of thing. We have, on the one side of the equation, the attempt to improve oneself. We also have an attempt to elevate oneself above other people. What about this?
It's very a crucial part in class. For this reason, it's one thing for you to be richer than I am and say I'm richer or more powerful or more educated. But as soon as you say you're genteel and I'm vulgar, spiritually you become a superior. I am at a lower moral and cultural level. So it adds a very deep sting to a class division.
Well, this is a continuation of what the Puritans would call the damned and the elect. Have I got this right?
Except the damned and elect is predestined. You could refine yourself. You could.
Yeah. It was a human agency.
Yeah, exactly. It was a religion of works.
What about the word respectability? How does that figure in your book, The Refinement of America?
Well, it has to do with the changing boundary of class. In the 18th century, gentility is the culture of the gentry, of the group that were the rulers of the colonies, and divided them from virtually everyone else, and was an adjunct of their governmental power. In the 19th century, as the middle class begins to adopt gentility, it no longer is genteel for the purpose of asserting political power. It is simply to maintain their respectability, which means that you define all those who are not genteel, huge portion of the population who lived in log cabins and in parts of the city that were not genteel, are thought of as unrespectable. So crossing that boundary is not simply a matter of becoming powerful in society, but really attaining some level of dignity.
Well, do the marginal, these people who don't have money and power and class and status, how do they figure in the refinement of America? Are they a sort of counterpoint definitional kind of thing here?
There is a definition of these people that has a degree of respectability to it without implying any refinement. That is the honest and good farmer. Mm-hmm. We find this in paintings, we find it in literature, good-hearted, wholesome country people.
That's the Jeffersonian ideal.
It's something of a Jeffersonian ideal, and it comes from England and Europe, and it continues everywhere else.
Do we still live with these aristocratic models, Dick Bushman? Before our conversation, we were talking about some recent scholarship in the 19th century. You have a great, if not deliberate, effort to separate high from low culture. Here at the end of the 20th, it's all collapsing together. We can't figure out what's high, what's low.
The fascination with aristocracy continues far deeper into the 19th century than I'd realized until I got into this work. But we're absolutely enthralled with it. I would say even through the early years of the 20th century, you think of the fascination and the poignancy of the Duke of Windsor's marriage and his abdication from the throne. Now when the royal family has marital mishaps, we look on slightly bemused, but there's no note of tragedy. I think we've really lost our fascination.
Well, we still have books and, I mean, we still have television programs like Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous.
But that is different.
How?
That is simply glitz. It does not...
Jealousy.
It does not have this spiritual quality of a higher level of cultural life. I think we've changed. Our goals now are all oriented around professions. We no longer have courts, we have corporations, and the acquirement of professional skill and becoming a true professional is the late 20th century equivalent.
Well, does this mean, Dick, that the refinement of America has happened, that it's there in the past, that it doesn't continue?
It is there in the past, but it is not forgotten or obliterated. Mm-hmm. It really has become second nature. we've rebelled against gentility. We rebelled against it as a culture, just as we turned on Victorianism. We continue to rebel against it because it's what our mothers teach us to do, to blow our noses and stand up straight and carry a handkerchief. But when we want to present our best selves, when we're going for a job, we obey all the rules.
Mm-hmm. What have you learned personally, Dick Bushman, about notions like refinement and respectability and manners and social carriage? Any of this come home to you?
What I've learned is that I have immense personal ambivalence about these things. I admired all the people in my life who taught me gentility. I admire its love of beauty and its amiability, but it does set up false standards by which we judge people and separate ourselves from people who do not deserve to be cut off.
Richard Bushman, I want to thank you again for contributing to Soundings. You are the author of The Refinement of America. We can look for this book here in the fall of 1992 from Alfred Knopf. You are a professor of history at Columbia University. It's been great having you at the Humanities Center. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you, Wayne.
This is Soundings, a program of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. You've been listening to conversations featuring Patricia Mayer Spax of the University of Virginia and Richard Bushman of Columbia University. In a moment, I'll tell you where to write if you'd like a cassette copy of this program. Patricia Mayer Spax's most recent book is Desire and Truth, published last year by the University of Chicago Press. Richard Bushman is the author of The Refinement of America, just published by Alfred Knopf. Send $5 for a cassette tape of this show, or $2 for a Soundings catalog. Write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. The program number this week is 632. That's number 632, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. We welcome your comments and suggestions. Next week, a portrait of history, family, debt, and drought, the uncertain future of farm life in the American South. Dan Butterworth will discuss his new book, Waiting for Rain, A Farmer's Story. Major funding for this program came from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund, Incorporated. Thank you for listening to Soundings. Please join me again next week at this time on this radio station. Until then, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. American Manners, this week on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Patricia Mayer Spax of the University of Virginia talks about her study of boredom and culture. Richard Bushman of Columbia University discusses The Refinement of America, a study of social mores in the United States. American Manners, this week on Soundings.